Welcome to the third audio pod from the series of public lectures organised by World Rights London Behind the Scenes programme. This lecture is entitled East End Figures. The speaker is Alan Hudson, Director of the Leadership Programmes for China, Oxford University Department for Continuing Education, and co-author of Basildon, The Mood of the Nation, and The 21st Century City, The Making of Citizens. Alan Hudson introduced this lecture by explaining that the history of radicals in London is one of exemplary citizens in relationship to the struggles of ordinary people. Alan's starting point is a book called The Making of the English Working Class by E.P. Thompson.
So there are common elements about how we understand our relationship to the city and who makes an impact on the city in terms of the people, the population. One of the problems about contemporary life in London, as I perceive it, is the reinvention of arbitrary cultural traditions in the context of a city whose whole purpose is to destroy them in a wonderful way. Because that's what cities do. They make and remake people, and people are part of their own making, in the way that Thompson uses that word in the sense of the making of the English working class. He's talking about 1790 to 1830, a formative period of industrialisation and early modernity, the move from the rural, where everybody knows you, you know your place, and that's the end of your life, to the city, where you can make yourself and a new life, and new relationships, and new possibilities in every single sense of that word. And he really goes on about that. He says it, the working class, the British people, the Londoners in our discussion, were present at their own making. They were conscious that this was a new way of living, with all the implications about that, all the possibilities, all the optimism about being able, up to a point, to decide and dictate what was going to happen to you. He also says, and I use this because I'm an old romantic, that the point of his work was to talk about the vanished and the dispossessed, the people who've been lost in history, whose traditions, whose cultures, whose identities were destroyed by this onward march of modernity, of urban living, of having the maelstrom of a city like London. And he says, this is also for the silk worker. So even for those people, and, you know, one is romantic about this, I'm romantic about this, to look at what's made you, where you've come from, and seek it out. It's a perennial discussion about the move from the rural to the urban, and it constantly comes back in London's life and any other city's life. So it's about touching the past. And my general point about this is if the future looks a bit uncertain, then the past becomes more attractive. So that when we arrive in the city and the city doesn't give us what we thought was going to happen, whether we're Huguenots in the 17th century or Jewish emigres from the pogroms or Bangladeshis or Poles or Ghanaians, if London is not paved with gold, then our identity from the past, which we actually ran away from, let's remember, actually becomes more attractive. So there is a discussion about what we want to make in the future and whether or not we can, how much we can hold on to from our identity, which we think we've inherited from the past. Have we inherited it through our genes or through a cultural template, you are what you are? Or have we decided that's a better way of understanding ourselves than what's possible in the future? And all these things, and I hesitate to say this because one of the other things I want to say is don't read the past from the present, is all these things are debates about the nature of London life from the middle of the 17th century. And they certainly become very, very apparent at the time of the Revolutionary Wars, 1780, 1790, 1800. They become absolutely paramount in the discussion around the Jewish migration at the turn of the 19th, 20th century, and they're with us today. So I want to do two things. I just want to do themes and chronology and avoid being sort of historically unspecific. Chronologically, I'm going to pick out certain moments in the history of London to try and illustrate those themes. So the themes are these. My first stab at the first theme was to call it the religious shell. And I was mixing up with the chronology, because when you look at London radicalism in the 17th century, which is basically about the English Revolution, which was the biggest upsurge in popular pamphleteering, of radical discussion, about the nature of being a citizen in this new environment, the city. And it happened more in London than anywhere else in Britain, even though it was happening all the time. Much of the discussion was posed in religious terms. And that's not difficult to understand, because most people still understood the world in exactly in religious terms. There's no other way of understanding the world. You couldn't never understand the world other than in fact that here you were, you're going to die, you needed some solace, and it was organised through a set of practices which were you more or less agreed to. And so every single discussion, even if it was radical, was in religious terms. If you look at the Franciscan order, if you look at Umberto Eco's book, The Naming of the Rose, about the poverini, the poor friars. Jesus was poor. There shouldn't be any rich. Everybody should be equal. It doesn't say this is unequal distribution of the products of production, you know, it can be organised in a more systematic way. It's done in religious terms. Yeah? And that happened in the 17th century. But it doesn't really work if you carry that through as a theme. So the way I would repose it, and this is in terms of people's aspirations, it's the difference between is and ought. It's the difference between the way the world is. I see the world as a religious person, as a poor person, and it's full of inequality. Therefore, the world ought to be like this, because my reading of the Bible or my holy text tells me that it should be. So the religious shell is to do with the isness of the world and the oughtness of the world. And this is very, very clear in the English Revolution, and it's even clearer in the defeat of the English Revolution, which is, in Thompson's terms, called the Chileism of despair, is when you cannot change the world in the here and now, then you imagine that the world will be different when you die, or that there is going to be a millennial relationship. Somebody's going to come back and transform the world. You can't do anything yourself, therefore somebody else is going to do it for you. The Chileism of despair. You can't do anything in the here and now after 20 years of revolution, and you have to do something. So in London, between the 1640s, the 1650s and the 1670s, there is a shift from the levellers, who say, we want this, to the Quakers, who say, let's just contemplate the nature of the world. And the ranters, who say, they rant, and this is onomatopoeic, yeah? Or the fifth monarchists, who say, they're going to come down and transform the world, you know? The extreme version of this is you end up in a Texan desert waiting for the space engines to come down. Yeah? It's the same sort of relationship. It's not worked here. Something else is going to happen. So the moral order is at the centre of radicalism. It's always been at the centre of London radicalism, the sense of there must be a moral order. The second theme is given by the city. The fact, and I've already made this point, is that the city brings together people who are diverse by its definition. You don't live in a small village where you know everybody. Yeah? You don't live in a place where your auntie knows who you're going out with. Yeah? You can do things which are anonymous. And that's wonderfully liberating. By its definition, that's what a city is. Incredibly liberating. It's also very dangerous because you don't know what's going to happen. Yeah? And that's the two sides of the city. Everything is up for grabs, and everything can grab you. And London, for most of the modern period, for most of the period we're under discussing, is the city par excellence. I was looking up the figures for this in the China context. Up until about 1550, 1600, Beijing was the biggest city in the world, and had been for 300 or 400 years before. From about that then until around about the First World War, London was the biggest city in the world. And at the time it meant something, because it meant the most development. So London was the preeminent city of modernity. It's a bit different now, because growth in cities doesn't necessarily mean development. because the biggest cities in the world aren't the most developed, Cairo, Mexico City. It's quite interesting in this context, back to China, is that no Chinese city is actually going to be much, much bigger than Los Angeles, because there are more of them, it's more developed. The biggest cities in the world are going to be in the south. They're big because everybody's been thrown off the land and there's nothing to do. In China and in Europe and America, cities won't get that big because they've got a diverse, more heterogeneous economy. But in the period of modernity that we're talking about, London was the biggest city in the world, and itself became an issue. The fact that you were living in a city created points of contact with people you wouldn't normally meet. Now, not by definition, but normally this creates change and radicalism, because you're forced to come to terms with living with people who are different from yourself. You have to get used to other people. And the arguments that you have with them have to be resolved in the public domain. They have to be political. They have to be social. They can't be private or cultural in the sense that I'm like this, you're like that. Yeah? They have to be resolved in the public domain. There are certain arguments about whether or not suburbs discombobulate this, because the point about suburbs is you choose to live with the people who like you. I'm suspicious about that, because I'm suspicious of all technical arguments about the relationships between people. But in cities, you're forced, normally speaking, to confront difference. The nature of London at the moment is the erosion of public space, whereby you're actually regulated in who you meet, and therefore you don't spontaneously have to meet people who are different from yourself. Whether it's the areas you live by through housing markets or shopping malls, the fact that you're not allowed to go in them, you know, if you happen to follow the fashion for a hood. But normally speaking, for 150 to 200 years, living in a city forces you, and London forced you to do this, to live with people who are different from yourself and to come to some accommodation with them. The third theme is the question of organisation and self-organisation. Because the city makes you organise. It makes you discuss with other people and organise around a set of common identities or a set of common beliefs. The example of this is the London Correspondence Society, which I think was formed in 1792, is the first working class organisation. What that really means in 1792 is it's the first organisation which decides that anybody can join. The first rule is that this organisation shall have numbers unlimited. It defies Groucho Marx, who would never be a member of a club that would have him as a member. It defies everything about the nature of identity, because identity means I'm this identity, you're outside, you can't come in. Think about that in relationship to Britishness. You're not part of our club. It says our numbers should be unlimited. We will take anybody. We'll take anybody if they think there is a serious social problem in this country today. The hard times, they had economic issues, and we want a reform of parliament, they had political issues. Other people think that the first movement of this nature was the Chartist movement, which is also British. So whether we're thinking about the London Corresponding Society or the Chartist movement in the 1830s and 1840s, that new form of collectivity where people come together, not because they're related, not because they have the same ethnicity, not because they have the same religion, but because they have a sense of the possible common humanity of the future, was a British and London phenomenon. Incidentally, and many people make this point, is that London radicalism was much more important in the early period of industrialisation, not least because no other place was as big. By the middle of the 19th century, the traditional forms of working class organisation were much stronger in the northern cities, places like Sheffield, Leeds, Manchester. And I think that's both a plus and a minus. The plus is there was a sense of solidarity and collectivity. The minus is that they were normally based around one industry and therefore potentially much more parochial. The interesting thing about London was it was never dominated by one industry. It was never dominated by one set of experiences. So again, people were forced to experience other people's way of looking at the world. It was much more heterogeneous than any of the provincial British cities And by the same token, any of the provincial cities of Europe or North America or Russia or anywhere else in the world. London's radicalism was always much more driven by ideas rather than workplace organisation. Therefore, it had a certain fragility, because as we all know, ideas are much more fragile. You can't touch them for a start. You know, people change their minds because you don't meet in the same factory all the time, that you don't necessarily have that same reinforcing of your experience. But at the same time, it had this much more initially utopian, but also much more universal aspect to its radicalism. So London was less parochial than the northern cities, and also less friendly. You know, people didn't talk to each other on buses. The other side of it was that people were not necessarily touched by those ideas. London's economy was much more diverse, much more prone to have tradespeople, small business people involved, and therefore it didn't have that same sense of what you might call the traditional forms of working class collectivity that you would associate with northern industrial towns. We might want to discuss whether that's a good or a bad thing. You could even do it in terms of Rover's Return versus the Queen Victoria as a centre of working class life. Discuss. So that's one thing. The fourth theme, which I've touched on, is the idea of where we come from and Britishness. The point I want you to think about is, and this is a horrible phrase, is the idea of asymmetrical cosmopolitanism. I got this idea from two sources. One was John Snow, you all know John Snow, who made the point about, he was asked to comment on the nature of Britishness, and he says, I don't feel British anymore, I'm a Londoner living in Europe. So the idea of the nation state is gone. London exists, Europe exists, because this is fine for a member of the chattering classes who's probably got friends in Milan, goes off to the opera. So that's one side of it, and the other side of it is the relationship of new people in London, because London is the... Can you imagine arriving in Britain and having to live anywhere other than London? Coming to Britain in the 1950s, say from Jamaica, and having to live in Dorchester? Or can you imagine being a Polish plumber and having to go and live in Havant? So the point about that is that London is the only place which is accessible to people from outside the country, which again reinforces the idea of its dynamic element. It's also more fraught because it's too rich. London is more extreme than any other place in this country in terms of its wealth distribution. Asymmetrical cosmopolitanism. It's easy to be cosmopolitan if you're rich. It's very difficult to be cosmopolitan if you're stuck in place. And we all want to be cosmopolitan, but it's very difficult. The history. The point about the English Revolution is it happened too early because everything was still unformed. But at the same time, it was aspirational, especially in London, where the Putney debates took place, because people had already worked out that the central problem was political liberty and economic rights. So at the Putney debates in 1649, not in the East End of London, something's happened outside the East End of London, very few things. Colonel Rainsborough, a great leveller and Londoner, made the point that we should all be equal because we'd all participated in the revolution. For really, I think the poorest he, different problem, that is in England has a life to live as the greatest he. And truly, sir, I think it's clear that every man that is to live under a government ought first, by his own consent, put himself under that government. I should doubt whether he was an Englishman or no. Even people who aren't English can work this out. Everybody has a right to decide on the nature of their government. In the political realm, 1649, 350 years ago, that debate was happening about the nature of civil liberties. In fact, and, you know, I'm very old-fashioned on this question, whenever I wake up in the morning and think about the government extending the destruction of habeas corpus, which is essentially what it's doing in its anti-terrorist legislation, I think about the struggles of people in London and other parts of this country to defend their rights about being able to say what they want, their free expression, and to deny the arbitrary right of the state to come in and tell them what to do. 1649, this debate was taking place, and it was a lot more positive. And even the government, even the wrong people in this discussion, had to accept that. So it means that Cromwell and Ireton were considerably to the left of Gordon Brown on the question of individual freedom. I jump forward. The other thing that I suppose one should make the point is that I've been making a lot about London and talking about it in generality, but until at least the end of the 18th century, most of what we think of London would have still been rural. So London was effectively here on in. We would have just been on the outskirts of London until probably the 1820s, the 1830s. We'd also been the other, because this part of London was darkness, yeah? There were more missionaries in the East End of London in the 1860s than there were in the whole of India and China. Everybody who lived here was a waste of space and also very dangerous. And as now, people used to come from the West End on their gap year, you know, to save us. But most of the people who made the radical parts of London at the time, at the end of the 18th century, early 19th century, the revolutionary period, were around Spitalfields. They were artisans. They weren't workers in the sense of industrial workers. They were small people. They were silk weavers, they were tailors, they were cobblers, they were candle makers. And they came together in the organisation that I first mentioned, the London Correspondence Society, and they decided for a penny a week that they were going to change the world. They met in a pub called the Bell Tavern in Exeter Street, which is now pretty much near the Old Bailey, and it's now part of a pub called the Old Bell Tavern, if you want to go there. And after their porter and tobacco, they didn't have that fetish about tobacco that we have nowadays, that they decided that the purpose of their meeting was for parliamentary reform and to reorganise the economic distribution of society. And within a year, or within 2 years, they had a subscription running into tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands at a penny a week. As it happens, at a time when bread was at the highest price since 1709. So the relationship between their willingness to participate politically and their economic problems was not exactly direct. It was a little bit inverse in relationship to this. Within 2 years, they'd been cracked down on. The secretary, Thomas Hardy's wife, was about to deliver when he was arrested and she lost her child. Most of them were put in prison. Some of them were summarily executed. And they were driven underground by a level of repression which had not been seen in this country for 150 years in terms of civil liberties. But they still were there. They were there in defence of the citizen. They were also there in defence of civil liberties. And peculiarly, and I think this is a point we should bear in mind in our later discussion, they were in the defence of patriotism. Because this was almost the last time, and this is me speaking directly, to say, I'm proud to be English or British, was a radical statement. If you remember the famous phrase, I don't know if you know this, of Samuel Johnson, who was a Tory in the middle of the 18th century, said that patriotism was the last refuge of a scoundrel. What he meant then was, patriotism was the remains of the revolutionary tradition for free-born English people. At the time of about 1800, patriotism had a battle between revolutionary fervour and the defence of the nation, when Britain was forced to fight France, revolutionary France. And at that point, patriotism became a different beast. It became an emblem of national identity as opposed to civil liberties. And I would argue, and you know, right up to this time, any political movement which espouses a radical cause which depends on its relationship to being British is intrinsically wrong and reactionary from this point in time. You cannot be pro-British and progressive in any real sense after the Revolutionary War. It's easy for me to say that because I can say it in relationship to 1800, but you've tried thinking that in relationship to the war in the Falklands or the war in Iraq, and you get a problem about that relationship between Britishness and patriotism and progressive politics. And it's a very important thing to bear in mind when you think about British radicalism. Its commitment to Britishness and the nation state is a fundamentally disarming feature of most radical movements since that time. The same point in a minor key is true of the Chartists. The Chartists were not a fundamentally London phenomenon. The Chartists is the great movement. This is the other movement, which is the first great international movement of progressive solidarity. And it's always a tension between the political and the economic. Should we have the Charter, which will give us parliamentary rights, or should we resolve our economic grievances? Should we use petitions? Some of them were invented. The last petition, I think, in the 1840s, had 1.5 million signatures, including Queen Victoria's. You know, she may have been a bit distraught after Albert died, but I doubt if she would have signed the charter. And the physical force element, which was, let's go and take it. Politics, economics, physical force, petition. But at the end of the Chartist movement in the 1840s, the dominant tradition of the North, which was Irish, as it happens, another interesting phenomenon, the Irish radical in British politics, came up against a new tradition in London politics, again about ideas, which was not merely about politics and about reform, but about socialism. And even though he's not as charismatic as Fergal O'Brien and O'Connor, the great Chartist leaders of the North, a guy called R.J. Herney was an instrumental link between the tradition of the London Corresponding Society through the 1840s and 1850s to the foundation of the First International. The First International of working people throughout the world was founded in London in 1864. Or the inauguration of that. A rather boring speech, I reread it last night, by Karl Marx on the question of the foundation of the First International. But again, in London, you had that very strange phenomenon of an indigenous political tradition meeting new sets of people. Because if you look at the delegates of the First International, it's a very strange collection of London tailors and Polish emigres. Great combination, not just Poles, of course, everybody else. They come together to announce a new way of organising the understanding about how the world can be ordered and changed. I just want to jump ahead and give you one more example. This battle about London, this battle about whether London maybe is a British city or maybe an international city, whether it's parochial, whether its radicalism is different, I think comes to a head in the period just before the First World War and then in the period of the 30s. Politics changes in Britain with the introduction of the franchise and the introduction of the masses in real terms. And in 1905, this becomes a really powerful political tool in a battle between nation and class. What I mean by that is that when new people vote, they make decisions about where their interests lay. And without being conspiratorial about it, the choices on offer were effectively, are you going to vote as a person who has no money by your class, or are you going to vote as a person who happens to live in Britain by your nation? And in 1905, the Aliens Act said that the large numbers of people coming into this country, largely from Eastern Europe, predominantly Jewish, not exclusively, were aliens. I mean, it doesn't quite have the same connotation as the Sigourney Weaver movie, but you get the picture, is that they are different. Therefore, you must vote English. You must vote British, not through class. So there's a competition about your allegiance. There's a competition about where you stand, what your identity is. So where do you sit on this? Where do you derive your identity from? Do you derive it from your class? Do you derive it from your nation? This is fairly simple. Now you can derive it from your sexuality, the fact that you prefer Armani to Versace, the fact that you're a West Ham supporter. In my personal terms, I derive my identity from not liking people who wear black loafers with white socks, etc., etc. Yeah? It's all much more light. Yeah. But then, class, nation, class, nation, class, nation. So everything goes in those terms. And you organise around that principle. Political organisations organise around that principle. You get to the 1920s and 30s where the victor in the first round, nation, in Britain, has won, but finds class coming back because nation isn't very good. So the nation, your commitment to the nation, hasn't really worked out. You've just had a world war, which got screwed up. You've just had a Great Depression. You've just got a ruling class, which is effete, you know, and not very pleasant. So lots of alternatives. But how do you get drawn back into that? You get drawn back by the idea that the left wing, the progressive people, are the ones that embody the tradition of the nation. So you go back and reinvent your relationship to the Civil War to say that the free-born Englishman, John Lilburn, then became the person who defended patriotism in the 18th century, who then became the forward march of Labour in the 19th century. So the real Britain is in fact the Britain of Labour. But the real Britain of Labour also then has to go and defend the British Empire, the nature of Britain. So the relationship between class and nation becomes confused. Or at least, if you're going to fight to defend Britain, you will not do it to defend king and country, but you will do it against fascist Germany. So the form of British nationalism becomes anti-fascism. Very interesting. And in fact, the form of British nationalism then becomes the welfare state. It then becomes, we fought not for king and country to return empire, but for the sort of common person that becomes the British person of the post-war period, which is absolutely crucial to the history of the East End in the post-war period. So progressive radical politics actually become a legitimation for a relationship to Britain. Now, I'm being very schematic here, I've just jumped, but I just wanted to put that out there. Now, the interesting thing, and the thing that perhaps we should discuss, is that at a certain point in the 1970s or 1980s, that version of Britishness no longer worked. It didn't work because it didn't provide a better country, or that much better. It didn't work because it didn't appeal to the new people, and all the other people were dying off. But the interesting thing is it hasn't been replaced by anything. So when Gordon Brown says, we must be British, he's calling into a wilderness. He's appealing to an imagined history of radicalism going back to the 17th century, but no one's listening because nobody understands the vocabulary. Nobody actually quite works out what he's talking about because we live in a world in which we confront real problems as individuals without any purchase on this form of invented history. Now, does that mean that we have to reject history? Not in my view. My view is that we should return to the way that E.P. Thompson looks at it, as that history is not a structure and it's not an invented idea, it's a set of real people grappling with real relationships. And if we remember that, then we possibly can come to terms with our own radical London or reinvigorated radical London. Now, that's an aspiration. I have nothing other than assertion for you on this question, but I'd be very interested to know what you think about the possibilities for a radical London at 10 to 8 on 15th of 2008.
This audio pod was produced by WorldRight's London Behind the Scenes programme. For further audio and video pods from the series, and for more information about WorldRight's other projects, please go to www.worldright.org.uk.